everybody, we'll go ahead and get this afternoon's workshop started. Scott and I are going to go back and forth for about an hour, and I'm looking forward to it more than anybody in this room, because I'm up here participating with one of my favorite people in AA. I love the way his mind works, and I think we're going to have a lot of fun. He asked me to start it off, to just lay out the topic, and we have chosen a paragraph in the big book, and since I haven't memorized it, it's very short, I want to read it, and this is what the workshop will be on, is on this paragraph. On page 53 in the We Agnostics, when we became alcoholics, crushed by a self-imposed crisis we could not postpone or evade, we had to fearlessly face the proposition that either God is everything or else he's nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? Now this occurs in a very crucial part of our sobriety, in this transformation that is necessary in the second step. And the moment is really huge when it gets to that paragraph, as far as I'm concerned. I'd like to focus to start out with on the word choice. What was our choice to be? God is either everything or he's nothing. It's like, it sounds so funny to say that that's a choice. I wonder if anybody informed God. Or does he have to live by that choice? I do not exist. The point is, until we make that choice, he really doesn't exist. That's the power of our own choosing. And we can live in a godless world that we created. And I know there's lots of discussions about whether man really has free will or not, is it, you know, the instinctual drives and the process of his heredity, etc. But I would say there's one area where that is completely a free choice, and it's right here. It's a choice of whether we choose God or not. It's not something that you can be taught. I was brought up in church, and I chose to leave. I didn't choose that at all. I said, I'm going to choose something else. And so this momentous moment is described, as you read the paragraphs that follow, it has to do with faith. And Bill makes a great point about walking across the bridge of reason, trying to cross into the land of faith. That is a huge difference. And if I had to come up with my own definition of faith, I would say that it is the cutting of the umbilical cord of self-sufficiency. It is the severing completely relying on reason. And if you've relied on reason for all your life, you are stepping into the unknown. And it's terrifying. And we only do it, as this was described in the book, because there's nowhere else to go. We are at the end of being able to exist on reason alone. There is a desperation, there is a moment, and I'm either going to do something that I've never done before, or possibly I could perish. And faith is born out of this cutting of the umbilical cord of reason. And the sound that it makes when it's born is universal. It's the same sound that has been made for thousands of years And it's one of the hardest sounds for a self-centered, intellectually self-sufficient person to make. It's terrifying to make this sound. And we make it with tears in our eyes. It's that frightening. And the sound goes like this. Hello! Remember how frightening it was to say those words? We never said it before. We have no idea whether anything hears that cry. Just like a baby has no idea if anyone's going to hear its cry. And we finally yell it loud enough, help! Wondering if there's any, is there anything that hears that? You see what a leap of faith that is? I have to abandon my own self-sufficiency and walk out into this, I don't know what area, and yell these words, help, and see if anything comes. And it sounds simple, but that is one of the hardest things to do that I remember, was to yell that word out and yell it louder and louder. And boy, was it wonderful to find out that someone and something hears that cry. And I am starting to shift my belief and my choice over in this new direction of a thing called God. And this is the moment that I think it happens. It's not an intellectual exercise. It's an exercise of desperation. Because faith is obviously in the unknown. We have no idea what is going to arrive in this new world. And it is a new world. One that does not make sense. One where things are revealed instead of being figured out. One in which all of our old ideas no longer apply. So we, at this moment, are making a rather monumental transformation in the way we see the world, the way we understand things, and it's the beginning of living on a different level. It's the beginning of a new pair of glasses, and I find it a very wonderful moment in our sobriety to talk about it. So I hope that laid the stage, and Scott, be my guest for as long as you want.
My name's Scott. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Scott.
And I can't thank Steve enough for throwing Sandy and I together for a workshop. We were supposed to do this a year ago, and some stuff happened with our family, and we got to be with Nancy's mom while she took her light to another room, and Sandy was kind enough to leave some instructions for me on the CD that he did, which was just great. And this is a big deal for me. I've been calling Sandy for about 4 years and asking for help. And I think sometimes he thinks we're just having a chat, and I'm asking for help. And I had some stuff in my sobriety. I'm 21 years now, so I started calling when I was about 17, and I was stalled out, and I was having a very tough time allowing myself to be sponsored. And I find that if I'm not allowing myself to be sponsored, it becomes very difficult to sponsor other people. It becomes a very dry, difficult situation. In the 60s, you either had taken acid or you hadn't, and that was pretty much it. And the people who had taken acid understood, the people who had not taken acid didn't understand. And I find the same to be true about God, that you're either, God's either everything or he's nothing, that you're either seeking God and living a spiritual life or you're not. A big difference for me, and a difference that's been a tremendous relief for me, is the difference between craving spiritual experience and seeking spiritual experience. I can seek spiritual experience in a very joyful way, sometimes in a very leisurely way, sometimes in a very, I recreate when I do that. When I crave it, there's a desperation. When I crave, I suffer. And there's a desperation connected to that, and it's usually because I'm seeking God to present in my life in a way that will alleviate me and get me something I want. That's usually the way that it positions itself. One time I called Andy and I
I just had this thing that was not moving for me. I'm going to share about my about some physical problems I had, and what does that have to do with sobriety? Absolutely nothing, unless you're going through it. It just doesn't. It doesn't have anything to do with sobriety specifically, unless you're going through it. You know, and I weighed over 300 pounds. My skeleton was breaking down. I didn't weigh over 300 pounds, but I was on the brink of losing the use of my legs, and I had a kidney failure. I was looking at an incredibly invasive, difficult back surgery. I called Sandy, and I couldn't change this thing. I had tried everything, just everything. And he just made such a beautiful observation about faith and such a beautiful definition. I want to make an addition to it. One of my teachers, who sees it just the exact same way that Sandy was talking about it, describes faith. He says, he used to confuse faith with belief, and he says, they're different. He says, my beliefs are, I like my beliefs because I believe in them, and they're comforting to me. And he says, faith is a different thing for me. He said, faith is the willingness to expose myself to the truth despite the consequences. It's such a perfect, and the way Sandy was talking about it, such a perfect expression of the action of step two, of a step into thin air. Of trusting in it. And at first I trusted in you guys, you know, and then I trusted in something else. This guy in my old home group used to talk about he used to tell this beautiful story about making the transition. And he told this story about a woman who was told in her home group that she could pray to anything she wanted. So she prayed to the tree outside of her house. And she prayed to it every morning. And she stayed sober praying to the tree. One morning she woke up, and a city vehicle was feeding the last branch of the tree into a chipping machine. And she went running as the truck rolled down the street. She went chasing it, screaming, "Oh God, save my tree." And that's when she that's when she made the move across the bridge to the shore. And you never know what will give you that little nudge. And I called Sandy to talk about this thing that just wasn't happening for me, and he said, "This is what I want. This is what I want you to do." I said, "What?" He said, "I want you to go to God's ready room." I said, "What?" He said, "Okay, God's got a ready room. It's like, you know, fighter pilots. It's like World War II. You go to a ready room, and you're going to be told what the mission is, okay? So you go in there, and you sit down with the rest of the pilots. God comes into the ready room. He gets up in front of the group, and he goes, 'Who's in for pain? I need a bunch of guys. Volunteer for pain.' I want your arm to shoot up and say, 'I'm in, I'm in.'" I reminded him of this later. He went, "What?" Absolutely had shared it in a brownout, had no recollection. In the meantime, I've started a whole religion dedicated to this. You know, I've got God's ready room. I've franchised God's ready room. I've developed a prayer book for God's ready room. And and what he suggested was that I volunteer for... cracked himself up. He suggested that I volunteer for the pain of change. And if God is everything and he's nothing, one of the things that the people in AA have shown me many, many times is exercise, is the drill. When all else fails, the drill. What's the drill? Now, I believe that faith without works are dead, and I also believe that works without faith are dead. I believe faith without positive action and without this self-interested altruism that we're involved in here, and I know that some people are selfless and some people are unbelievably selfless, but I really do believe that what we do here is a splendid device of we really receive so much for what we do. You know, I always like to remind myself of that when I'm on the brink of becoming a little too good. This thing I was trying to change, and I was basically, you know, writing inventory about myself for being overweight and being injured physically, and I'd say, "Pop, what do you got?" "Go to OA." I go, "Okay, what else you got? Because I can't go to OA. I'm a circuit speaker. I'm way too spiritually developed." that's beginner stuff, you know. And I just kept suffering and suffering and suffering. And I was doing the same drill. I was doing the same behavior. I was doing the same stuff, which addressed itself. But you know what? I'm changing, and works without faith are dead. If the actions that I'm taking in Alcoholics Anonymous, after a while, if they're not tethered to a spiritual pursuit, they become very hollow, dry things. And I've heard Sandy describe it as part of the backbone of the retreats that he has started to do. You know, I've met many, many people who have been sober a long time who have gone over and over the work in the same way, and it starts to fall apart in your hands. It starts feeling like a mouthful of ashes. And there's nothing wrong with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm failing. One of my teachers said to me recently, we were talking about my childhood, which was not fun for anybody. I don't think anybody had a good time. And my teacher said to me, imagine having a mother who is very vigorous and vital and spends her life seeking new ways to invigorate that vitality and seek new ways to ignite it. And I said, what? And I can find that in God. I can find that in my relationship with God. If God is everything, you know, and if I am seeking God instead of craving God, it's really two very, very different things. So eventually when I was willing to change my actions, to change my drill and start doing something else, and I went to OA and I said, you know, I'm a circuit speaker, and they said yes, and I'm a very fat circuit speaker. I said, would you like me to speak? And they said, no, and your mouth's full. And I was a 15-year losing slipper, loser in Overeaters Anonymous. Until it took my breath away. Again, what does it have to do with sobriety? Absolutely nothing unless you're going through it. And then I did the thing that I have seen you do so gorgeously, so beautifully, in a way when I see a newcomer push back from the table and go, oh my God, that is what you do? That's a way out? That is a way out. That is an absolute 100% way out. And I was just willing to be a newcomer, and have, you know, the unsolicited advice people talk to me and, you know, all the other stuff that we go through. There's a wonderful Zen teacher that talks about Zen mind, beginner mind, and he talks about that the expert has nothing to learn, but the newcomer always does. I want to keep a newcomer mind. I want to keep a newcomer posture. I want to stop being so prickly. If God is everything, then I can't have propriety over God. If God is everything, how can I claim ownership? And when I ascribe an intention, a personality, a point of view, a specific way to approach that thing, then I smell ownership. And ownership, I see around me this illusion of separation and ownership and propriety, I see it as the root of so much of the miserable, miserable stuff that goes on behind us. And then I come back to Alcoholics Anonymous, to the men and women of Alcoholics Anonymous, to this connective tissue that I am delighted and fortunate enough to get the opportunity to just blow on the embers of. So today I'm very, very happy in God's ready room. And I am I'm not only volunteering for the pain of change, but I'm also volunteering for the splendor of joy, because I believe pain is not the touchstone of spiritual growth. I believe it's a touchstone of spiritual growth, and I believe that quite often it's the main touchstone of spiritual growth, and quite often I grow because I'm in joy, too. So thank you.
Thanks, Scott. Terrific. One of the things I struggled with this idea God is everything or is nothing is the, I don't know if I mentioned this story earlier or somebody else did, but it captures it for me, the two young fish swimming in the ocean, the old fish comes by and says, how's the water, boys, and keeps going, and they turn to each other going, what's water? And I kind of have the same feeling when you say, God is everything. And I'm going, well, if he's everything, why haven't I seen him? Why haven't I? How could he be everything and I have no awareness of him at all. If I got totally honest, if you were in my world before I started working these steps, you could put a lie detector on me and somebody said, have you ever seen God, been aware of God? I would have said no, and it would have said I was telling the truth. I mean, once in a while I'd look up at the stars and go, wow, somebody made those. But that wasn't God is everything. Like me and you and this table. And so how could I have ended up in a world that looked like there was no God? I mean, well, the answer to that is how separation from God occurs. In other words, that's the problem. Chuck talked about it. Our problem is being separated from God. And in my old mindset, I would have said, well, then I better do something to please God so that he will come back. You follow what I'm saying? Like God went somewhere. I mean, where could he go if he's everywhere that he could come back to? So my picture of this separation was faulty. That wasn't what was going on at all. Well, then how can this separation occur? I mean, when you stop and think, if God is everything, how could you possibly be somewhere that God isn't? And yet I spend a whole lifetime there. Well, where was I? You follow what I'm saying? There's only one. It turns out, I mean, you feel so foolish when you find out. You go, God damn, I wish I hadn't found that out. If you want to live in a world totally separated from God, you make up a story that you live in a world totally separated from God. And then you believe it. And that's called an ego. That's what the ego does. It makes up a story much as a dream. Have you ever noticed that you're always in your own dreams? Most of the time, you're the star of your dream. I mean, I never woke up and there was, the only guy in the dream was Scott. You know, Scott's running and playing tennis and having a happy day, and then I wake up. I'm the center of my dream. It's all about me. Guess what happened? And they're generally frightening, scary, close to nightmares, and I have a pattern. We all have a pattern. That's our way of telling dream stories to ourselves. And so it turns out that ever since we were little and found out that we had the capacity to editorialize on our own life, we did. And the best analogy that I've been able to come up with, and I'm going to try to work harder, but I was using it in Tampa, is using Shakespeare's analogy that the world's a stage and we're actors on it. Because describing the ego is not easy. You have to make up stories about it. So supposing, for the sake of trying to paint this picture, that you're an actor or an actress, you went to the agent and they got you a role in a play, and you showed up, tried out, and they said, great, you're perfect for this part in the play. You're on stage when the play starts, sweeping the floor. And you sweep, 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 sweep. You're kind of the janitor. And then the story evolves at this busy office. It's a brokerage firm, and people are in and out. And then they chat with you throughout the play. And then the play ends with you sweeping the floor. Well, it's a wonderful story. So you go, oh, good, good, good. So you're out there, and after a couple weeks, you realize that you're the person sweeping the floor. And there's a guy who gets the girl, who's up on the second floor, a big shot broker and everything. And you start going, I wonder why I'm not the guy on the second floor and I'm the person sweeping the floor. Your only role is to sweep the floor. And as time goes on, you start realizing the huge tragedy that is taking place on that stage as you sweep the floor. All of this talent of an incredibly wonderful actor or actress is being totally wasted in this role. As a matter of fact, every night during the play, there's a bigger play going on the stage. If the audience only knew what a tragedy they were watching. If they could see the real play of this person being abused this way, right in front of them on the stage. And pretty soon, the story that becomes our own reality is how awful it is that I have a role of sweeping the floor on the stage. And then I believe it. And that's all I talk about. And that world is the one that the ego creates. It creates a whole story about me. And it's not what my higher power had in store for me. He just had me to be a human being here, spiritual and human, having a human experience, and everything that I was supposed to be in the play, and that was it. And if I just was in the play and just swept the floor, I'd be taken care of and I'd be happy, joyous, and free. But I decided there had to be more than that. I wanted a bigger role. I wanted to be the center. And so I created this place, and there's no God there because I'm the center of it. And it goes on for years and years, and it becomes reality. That is what's really going on that stage, is this terrible tragedy. And no one out in the audience can really see the tragedy. Only I can see it. So I talk to other people about it at the bar. Do you know what it's like to play the role of the sweeper? When there's brokerage people getting rich and all of that. That's the world that we lived in. I had no clue. And I remember hearing a speaker, and I've talked about this guy. I just love him. And he got up and said, ladies and gentlemen, my story is divided into two parts. What happened during the years that I drank and what I thought happened during the years that I drank. And that's very funny. But here's the irony. This is the illusion that Chuck C. was talking about. My life was divided into two parts. What happened during my life and what I thought happened during my life. And the transformation to go over into the world of faith is the only hope I have of getting out of the world that I created. That's why Bill Wright's old ideas availed us nothing. It's the same dream, doing the same thing, expecting different results. I will rely on me one more time. I will tell the same story. I will repeat this, and I will get the same results, which in a very basic way are not real. I mean, our basic nature is happy, joyous, and free. And that's what was given to us. We decided to change it without realizing it into restless, irritable, discontent, and anything else that enables us to have problems to fix. So the joke that I play on myself is to spend my life solving problems that I created. Now that's a strange existence, and it takes an earth-shattering, life-threatening event to break it. There's just no way out of it. So alcoholics, we are so lucky that we were driven to this point of being willing to abandon reason in favor of faith. Let me turn it back to Scott.
Thanks, Sandy.
Low-grade industrial hum.
Could you, like, stop it, please? No, okay.
When I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was fortunate enough to defer my critical thinking over to somebody else. I didn't know that's what I was doing, but that's what happened to me. I deferred my critical thinking over to somebody else. And my... I was so bankrupt as a going concern that I experienced a deflation of ego at depth that was absolutely shattering to me. And I was really fortunate because I was with people who knew that their job was not to present as godlike figures in that. That their job was to shepherd me to some kind of experience where that deflation of ego at depth could be, where I could be reinvigorated and filled with something else, really with the spirit that that runs the universe. And it's a really interesting thing. The description of the third step says the first thing I have to quit doing is playing God. I have to stop playing God. And how that presents itself is a very complex and interesting thing. I have struggled for years with the difference between being irresponsible and playing God. And as I've developed in sobriety, I trust myself more to not play God. So I'm more interactive in a lot of situations where before I just would have said nothing. I had an experience with a guy I sponsored who he was just one of those great guys. He looked like he had been shot from a cannon when he came into AA. He was just shattered, you know, and lived on the floor of his crack dealer's house. And he was sober about a year, and I used to pick him up every week for our home group. And I picked him up one day. He said, "I met this woman 3 months ago. She's pregnant. I want to marry her and have the baby. What do you think?" And because I don't have any rules, I don't have any hard and fast rules, I knew the guy wasn't a sexual predator. I absolutely did not know what the right or wrong thing was to do. And I said, "I have no idea. If he was another guy, maybe I would have said another thing." I said, "If you want to have the baby, I'll come to your wedding. And if you don't want to have the baby, tell me what I can do to help." And they had the baby, and I was his best man. And the baby was born, and they were incredibly sick and had 1 foot in the grave. And we went to the hospital, and the baby was put on an awful machine that just was incredibly invasive. And the AA army showed up, you know. You got to be... Remember the family to go to neonatal intensive care, and her family showed up, you know, 6'6" Ethiopian men, small Asian women. And after a while, the nurses would say, "Don't pause to lie, just go in." And, and the call went out for blood. And, you know, most of us can't give blood because we're either ex-hypes or we have fresh ink, but we just go to get pissed off because they won't take our blood, you know. And they were home about 6 weeks with the baby, and the hospital called them and said, "They're still coming with blood, man. They're bringing it in jars. They just won't stop bringing the blood." And I could have, I don't know if I could have, but I possibly could. Now, did their marriage work? No, it didn't. Boy, what a shock. 2007, a marriage didn't work. That'll bowl you over, in sobriety or out. But a demonstration was made that was absolutely extraordinary. An AA community, an Al-Anon community, showed up for this baby and was involved on this on an incredibly intimate level. The best acting is described usually as being private and public. And this was an intimacy, a public intimacy that was overwhelming. And nobody was pushing and shoving and grabbing and telling people who could come and who couldn't come, and there was no gatekeeper. There was just none of that stuff. It was the big oxygen, the big spiritual democracy of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's up to me.
make a demonstration. It's up to me to demonstrate. If I sit here and wait to get hit by a meteor, it's just not going to work. It's not going to happen. Not for me. You know, and when Sandy talks about water, what's water? You know, I've been living in this spiritual ether with demonstrations my whole life. One of my biggest pieces of self-delusion when I got sober is that I thought I was, you know, boy, look at this spiritual pursuit. I wish more people knew about this. I'm a little late to market, like thousands of years late to market. People have been doing this stuff for a long time and getting incredible relief, incredible comfort. And one of the things that has been interesting for me is when you experience that deflation of ego at depth. I've had men, when they're working on their inventory, say, geez, you know, I've written this stuff, it's making me feel lousy, can I come over and read you what I've got? I encourage them not to. The book doesn't say, write a little, read a little, write a little, read a little. It says, if you read the whole thing, if you tell the whole story, if you have to say I'm resentful at a couple of hundred times, if you do the whole thing, the evidence and the awful exhibition of the misery of I'm resentful at them, I'm resentful at me for resenting them, I'm resentful at them for watching me resent them, and I've had sex with all of them. Right? And I'm scared of all of them. How do you even live? How do you live in that kind of bondage? And of course you don't. You know, I used to say, the fact is I did what alcoholism told me to do. I did it whenever it told me to do it, and I did it for exactly how long it told me to do it for. A couple of months before I got sober, I reached for something at our dinner table, and our 6-year-old son recoiled from me like I was going to smack him in the face. And I just went, oh my God. God, how did this happen? How did we wind up here? How did I wind up this repulsive to this gorgeous little boy? And a couple of months ago, my son emailed me, and the email was two sentences. It said, I just felt overwhelmed with how much I love you. And I know that that has nothing to do with me. And I know that I'm lucky, because just because I grow spiritually doesn't mean that my kid's going to like me. Or that our family is going to come together, or anything like that. It doesn't mean that at all. It's just what's happening in our house, you know? And these illusions, these delusions, I didn't know that I had this choice. When Sandy talks about that play, you know, and instead of seeing yourself as some schlep, you know, craving that experience of being that stockbroker, I was raised with a very poor self-assessment, and that's something to know. That's something to be mindful of. I sponsor guys who were raised in alcoholic homes. I find that they have a little extra on the plate when they do 12-step work, because part of the deal with that is they grow up feeling like it's not going to work out. I'm going to get tricked. They're going to trick me. The alcoholic's going to trick me. I don't sponsor guys who on a continuing basis who use that as an excuse. We find a way to take that and be mindful of it and see it as the illusion that it is, you know? And part of that for me, and it's an interesting thing to be mindful of, I grew up in a really dangerous, really bad situation when I was a kid. And part of the fallout from that is I tend to see my problems as outside of myself. I see them, I'm going to get, it's going to happen, here they come, man oh man, it's going to happen, you know? And it can happen at any time, and I have no control over it, and I'm just, you know, I'm just I'm a rabbit in the middle of a field of short grass. Great way to live. And part of the result of living that way, of seeing my problems as outside of myself, is I when I bring that to a relationship, that's very difficult. When I bring that to my relationship with God, it's very unsatisfactory, and it's an illusion. It's an illusion. It's something I was brought up with. It's something I've continued and cultivated. It's something I've nurtured and repainted. And then eventually I became the bad dad. I became the problem outside of them. You know, and I don't believe that my problems, and it's not fun to be married to that either. When the person that you live with takes perceived criticism as annihilation, absolutely annihilation. you know? You miserable son of a bitch. I hope you die in a flaming car crash. Oh, I meant pass the salt. I'm sorry. All she said was pass the salt. That's all she said. Anton Chekhov, a wonderful Russian playwright, said when he was asked what his ideal of the theater was, he said, the theater should be like eating dinner with your family. During the course of the meal, all that is said is pass the salt and more butter, please, and yet by dessert, your life is destroyed. Welcome to my life. But it's not, it's something, you know, I'm putting it on the table. I want to throw it on the table for God's good examination. I want to bring it up above the horizon and discuss it with the people I love, the people who help me, you know, the people who I've allowed in. And the thing that Sandy talked about that illusion, I never got the choices that I had in there. I never got how much it was being painted. And part of the reason was I just hadn't been seeking long enough. I didn't know that I saw all my problems outside of myself. I thought I could work it out with you. I can't work it out with you. Not when I identify you as the source of that thing. As opposed to it being part of this picture I paint, and let me come to you and say, you know what, I need to be mindful of this. This is something I do. I really don't want to do it with you. You know, let's do something else together. So it's a great thing to talk about. Thank you.
Great job. Great, Scott. As we progress in our awakening, which I think is how we describe spiritual growth. Since the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, that means there's one result. That's the only result of the steps, an awakening. So carrying the message is you carry a message to someone about how to awaken. Now, granted, we can do other things, but if we miss the awakening part, then we've missed the whole point of the program. Because those solutions are what Chuck called a new pair of glasses. And there's a monstrous difference between the intellectual solutions and the traditional things and the seeing it differently. And just to take a few of them, we talk about fear and walking through the fear. With a different pair of glasses, we could see through the fear. What I mean by that is, it would be revealed that what's really there is nothing to be afraid of. Our ego saw it incorrectly. You follow what I'm talking about? This is not a threatening situation. You saw it incorrectly. There's nothing to walk through. That's an entirely different situation. That is awakening further. As Chuck would put on, whoa, I thought it was a bear. It's a bush. Oh, okay. I guess I don't have to summon my courage and walk by the bear. In other words, so these things, we pick up a kit of simple spiritual tools. The mistake that I made for many, many years was to forget that those tools are power tools and they have to be plugged in. It all has to do with God. In other words, I want to go out and forgive somebody, the tool of forgiveness. But I can't do that unless I'm plugged into my higher power. Everything has God in it. All of the steps have God. Somebody asked me, what does fourth step have to do with God? What is the eighth step God? What is the? In other words, it's everywhere. Now, when God becomes the center of everything, I mean, look at the tenth step. I love to talk about the 10th step in discussion meetings, just to make a good point. The 10th step says in the big book, we've entered the world of the spirit. This is a whole new world. That's what I was talking about when we walked across the bridge of faith. Now you're in the world of the spirit. Well, what happens in the world of the spirit? Oh, if you're in the world of the spirit, this is how it goes. Are you ready? Yep, I'm all ready. Okay, let's say you get frightened, angry, resentful, envious. Yeah. You ask God, it wants to remove them. Okay, is there something else? No, that's it. Now we're going to move on to other things. We have to talk. Okay. So can you imagine discussion meetings if we all did that? Okay, Mary, what do you want to talk about? Well, I just got fired today, and I was terribly threatened by it, but I have got to remove it. I'm fine. I'll pass. What about you? Well, my husband announced he's leaving me for a younger woman. It tore me asunder. I was so raging and jealous and envious. I asked God to remove it. He did. I'll pass. Hell would be bored to death in there. I asked God to help me. He did. So we got to come up with other answers. And the answers leave God out. That's what an ego wants to do. Well, what do you? Well, what I do? You ready? What I do? And then we come up with whatever you do, leaving God out. And then it's my turn, and I tell you what I do in order to resolve the situation and leave God out. That's the power of the old world. When we're to abandon the world of reason is not easy. That's why, and here's what happens. At least this is what happens to me. When we turn our lives over, as we did with our alcohol problem, the results we get are remarkable. I mean, it is a sense of well-being that is astounding. And I've actually had my ego get involved in praying. Egos don't pray, so you got to watch out. If your ego taps you on the shoulder and says, could I try praying, I would watch out for it. Because an ego prayer looks something like this. God, I want to thank you for all of the wonderful things that you have given me. You have taken a completely helpless, hopeless, frightened person and turned him into a useful citizen of society. You've turned him into a loving father whose children love him. You've turned him into a good worker who is now earning a good living. And I want to thank you, God, for all of this and returning me to a position where I no longer need your sorry ass. That would be the ego. Expressing all this alleged gratitude for returning me to self-sufficiency. This is the knife in the back. When will I be back in charge? When will I be self-sufficient? It's as if AA were a bicycle, and you rode a bicycle to sobriety, and all you had to do was stay on the path, and you would have the kingdom, happy, joyous, and free. And you notice that there's training wheels on the bicycle. And you go, well, I guess they put that while you're getting the hang of it. But now you got 10 years, and those training wheels are starting to bother you. And you start asking somebody, when do they come off? And you find out they never come off. You're going to always have to rely on something other than yourself. Now, if you've been sober 25 years and still have training wheels, and the guy with 1 month has training wheels, you would like to have some separation between you and him. And you'd like to get rid of those. That must, at some point, you must be further along than someone else. And that's not it. It's all being done by my higher power. Another example are the promises, which probably are the equivalent of saying something like, if you are painstaking about this phase of your development, next Thursday, you will be able to walk to the moon. You will also be able to drink the entire pond out there, the swimming pool, in one gulp. And you will be able to pull anything you want out of a hat. And then I said to you, are those extravagant promises? You would go, holy cow. Well, these promises are unbelievable. And yet we say, are these extravagant? He says, no, I don't think so. Why aren't they extravagant? Because they're being done by God. That's why they're not extravagant. For him, it's nothing. Oh, you want self-seeking? You go, look at that. Try to have self-seeking leave on your own. Just so you see how monumental all of this is, but it's nothing for our higher power. The hardest part that we have is staying connected to help. We focus on giving help. Oh, yeah, I got to give help. I got to give help. The longer you're sober, the quicker you pick the phone up. That's how I discern between a newcomer and an old timer. The old timer has something that's starting to get under his skin or her skin a little bit. You just grab the phone. Hello, Mary, can I run something by you? Thank you. Oh, I got to make an amend. Thank you. Phone, phone. Problem over. 45 seconds. Newcomer? Maybe I should talk about this, but maybe I could figure it out myself. I hate my boss. Should I kill him? Maybe I should kill him. Maybe I won't. I'll go home and work on this. I got to work on it. You got a problem? You got to work on it. How do you work on it? Well, you think about it. I got to think it through. I want to think it through. I'm going to think it through. I'm going to think it through. I will kill him. Okay, I'm going to kill him. I'll check with my sponsor, see what he has to say. He'll probably agree with me and help me kill him. Okay. What? I have to make an amend. You follow what I'm saying? It is staying connected is the trick. And it all begins with this leap. Scott, you got the last, whatever we got left.
Thanks, Andy.
Wrap it up.
One of the guys I sponsor who I'm very, just adore. When I first started sponsoring him, he was sponsoring three guys who were living together, and he didn't really know me that well. And one of the guys, Frank, and two of the other guys didn't know what to do about it. And I said, he asked me what to do, and I said, this is what you ought to do. You and the two other guys put your big books in a pillowcase and get together and beat the third guy to death with them. And it'll bring you closer together. It'll be a big thing you did with your big books, so it'll be a spiritual thing, and you'll have a secret which will really. And it was just, the phone was just dead for about 5 minutes. While Sandy was talking, I just, something occurred to me really for the first time. I think Jesse was about 5 years old, and they were reading a book in his nursery school called Runaway Bunny. And I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't know the book that well, but it really describes my feeling about my relationship with God. In the book, a bunny says that he's going to run away, and his mommy, is it his mommy? Says, I'll become a crocus in a hidden garden. And she says, I'll become a gardener, I'll get you. And he keeps saying, I'll become this, and she says, I'll become that, and I'll become. And when they read it to Jesse, he said, I'll run away, I'll do this. And Jesse said, my dad would come get me. He'd come get me. And that was a big thing for me because I had become such I just wasn't a father who could be relied on to be consistent. And he said it with absolute assurance. That will not work. I can't run away. My dad will come and get me. And I know that God will come and get me. And I know that I'm not making it very difficult for him to come get me. Because I don't think God drives parked cars. I think you got to pull it out in the highway. And as long as I'm pulling it out in the highway and I'm exposing myself to the truth despite the consequences and I'm into the deal, and if 12-step work becomes uncomfortable to me, it's because there's something wrong with the way I'm doing it. I called Sandy, this is some years ago, and again, I was just suffering. I was in physical pain. Stuff wasn't changing, and I just needed help. And he said, okay, listen, I've been thinking about this thing. I said, what? He said, you know those nightclubs where there's a velvet rope, you know, and you can't get in? I said, yeah, okay. He said, okay, you're trying to get in the nightclub, okay? And God's the doorman, all right? And he pulls back the velvet rope, and he goes, you, and you, and he points to you, he says, you're in! That's it? Yeah, that's it. So I just did that. He has absolutely, believe me, no recollection of this at all.
And again, I built a religion around it, but I just did this wonderful, sweet mantra of, Scott, you're in. You're in. Right here, right now. It's right here in real time. There's nothing to wait for. It's right now. The problem is if you stop doing this thing that's hurting you, you're going to have to take the whooping. Like when you stop drinking. And I have this phrase I use now. I say to myself, drop it and walk away. Same way you did with drugs and alcohol. At a certain point, you stopped talking about it, and you dropped it, and you walked away, and then suffered the consequences, some of which were gorgeous, some of which were not. You know, I remember when Nancy and I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and the phone rang at 1 o'clock that afternoon, and my wife came in looking like amazed and said, someone's, you know, wants to talk to you. And it was one of the guys at that meeting who had taken a look at me and took my phone number and didn't wait for me to call and took the action and called me. And we were both floored. His name is John H. I love him to pieces. I talked to him last week. We are still 21 years later. He says, I saved his life. Ha, ha, ha. You know? And if you took me since the day I got sober and you get a timeline of problems, I could tell you what the problems were, like any good timeline. I had the sex problem, the money problem. I had the they're thinking behind me, my back problem, then the sex problem, then the they're thinking behind my back and talking behind my back, and then the money problem, then I had the sex problem. Then I had, but you could do the timeline, and the funny thing is I'm the same guy through every single one of those. I am fine. I am always fine. A lot of bad stuff happens to me. A lot of challenging, a lot of bad stuff happens to me. Me got operated on. Me suffered physically. Me has had a difficult time and has had terrible cravings. The Buddhists say that enlightenment is the end of suffering and that craving and attachment cause suffering. And when Alcoholics Anonymous, when I get scared, when I think God presents in one way, when I forget that God is everything, and I think that you've got to do this and do this 10-step this way, and you've got to get these defects down, and I've done this when I've been over sober, I have done this, that you've got to do it this way and this way with this defect, and you can't use a form, and blah, 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 blah. And I'm telling people how to find, how to have their life renewed daily by a radiance, the source of which is beyond my comprehension. Imagine trying to explain that, control that, put a steering wheel into that. It's insane. It's unsatisfying and it doesn't work. I am fine. A lot of bad things happen to me. And when I know that, when I have faith in that, I'm really hooked into something. That despite my difficulties and despite my suffering, when I am not making that change, when I'm not giving myself over to it, and I'm making it an entrenched position, when my activity, my behavior, and the demonstration of my belief in AA becomes an entrenched position, then I'm in real trouble. And I've done it many times, and I've suffered many times because of it. There's this wonderful story about this talk that Buddha gave at, I believe it was on a place called Vulture Mountain. And he brought all his followers together, and one of his disciples, his foremost disciple actually, gave the talk while he went to deep meditation, and he gave the talk that Buddha wanted to give. And he basically said to all of his followers, stop codifying what I'm teaching you. Stop taking what I'm teaching you and turn them into these rules. Stop taking what I'm teaching you about being groundless. And you turn your, you know, now Buddhism, I love when you have to wear like happy slacks and a special hat and all of this stuff. You've taken this message of groundlessness and you've turned it into this thing. And in the legend, it says several people had heart attacks and died. This Buddhist nun that I listened to says that she thinks that probably just excused himself and went to lunch, but that what they said it was so horrifying to them that they died. There's a wonderful spiritual teacher named Krishnamurti. who was being groomed as a child to take charge of this sect. And he was finally given the sect, and the first thing he did was disband it. The first thing he did was say, "Hey guys, go home. This is exactly what we shouldn't be doing." And that's, to me, the gorgeous spiritual democracy of Alcoholics Anonymous. We have trusted servants. We have a group conscience. We have these traditions that sociologists have been studying for years. There's no reason why they should work on a group level, you know, or an organizational level. And do we have leaders? Absolutely. I need leaders. I need leaders. I need examples. I need people who will pick me up and love me and pry my jaws open and breathe life into me. I need the message. Sometimes I need it hard. Sometimes I need it really soft, and I need a kiss on the ear, you know. And I've always had it. As long as I keep showing up, as long as I make myself available for this thing, then I live in this big, robust, gorgeous, sexy, delicious universe where God is everything. And when it starts to get small, when it starts to get cramped, I know that I have to make another surrender and maybe go through some difficulty because of it, but I have to start doing something else. Thanks so much for showing up today.